Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Marco Rubio went all Trumpy this week, even saying Donald Trump was worried he wet his pants at Thursday's debate, where Rubio finally hit him hard. But on Friday, Trump played his Trump card, an endorsement from Chris Christie. Plus, two big national security stories. President Obama is trying to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay again, and the FBI wants Apple to help them hack the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the KCRW podcast Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest is Juliette Kayyem, host of the WGBH podcast Security Mom and former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. Welcome to all of you. So just before we went to tape, like 45 minutes before we went to tape, Chris Christie endorsed Donald Trump for president, shocking basically everybody. Christie said nobody's better positioned to provide leadership around the world than Donald Trump is. And he also said Trump is the candidate Bill and Hillary Clinton will most fear facing in November. So, Rich, what I have here in the script is to ask if you'd like a drink. But I guess what I want to know is, why do you think Chris Christie did this, and is it going to matter?
Well, I think Chris Christie had a choice to sit alone in Trenton and serve out his term as governor and go quietly in the night, or to be sitting every day on Trump's plane at the center of the political universe. And that's not a close choice. And this is a really, it's a big deal for Trump. In the most immediate terms, it changes the news cycle away from what was a pretty poor showing in the debate the other night. And it doubles down on his brand as the tough talker, you know, because Christie is that way himself, and he's going to validate that part of Trump's message. And more importantly, going forward, it gives him a vicious and eager surrogate who will go after Marco Rubio with relish. And finally, it just Christie's message to other elected officials is, come on in, the water's fine, get on the Trump train.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a key thing, because one of the defining characteristics of Trump's campaign to this point has been the complete lack of institutional support for it. He finally picked up his first two member of Congress endorsements this week, one from the Buffalo area, one from Southern California. But this is the first guy anybody's heard of who's supporting Trump. And it seems like you could have, for example, some of the governors who have lined up behind Christie coming in after that. Juliette, what do you make of that shift? Is this finally giving people license to treat Donald Trump as a serious person months after the voter base apparently decided it would do that?
Yeah, I think there's sufficient evidence to suggest that enough people feel that they have that license. What I think is interesting about this is it really also solidifies what I believe is about to happen, at least as we head towards the general, is that security, 9/11, counterterrorism, and those kinds of issues will really be at the forefront of the general fight between the Republicans and the Democrats. If you look at the Democratic primary now, yes, there's talk of Hillary Clinton's vote in Iraq, and there's talk about, you know, various issues sort of tangential in terms of the core of the Democratic primary fight now, which is really what's the meaning of progressive. That will end, and it probably will end relatively soon. And then you will have, I think, a debate with Christie, who's, you know, never fails to invoke 9/11 or his role in prosecuting 9/11 cases, and Trump, who's going to, you know, do whatever he can to protect America, whether it's a wall or ignoring China. I don't know what his philosophy is, but I think that this is going to put security at the forefront of the general as well.
Bob, I'm wondering what you make of this in the context that you sometimes bemoan the sort of shift of the Republican Party away from some of its prior ideals into a more extreme position. And arguably what we're seeing with Trump and Christie is the solidification of a moderate coalition between the Republican Party. Chris Collins, the member of Congress who went ahead of Christie by a few days, is also a relative moderate. If any of these moderate governors who've been behind Christie follow with Trump, this will be the relative, what we would have said in Congress were the relatively non-extreme parts of the Republican Party. Is this what you thought a moderate coalition would look like?
You put Trump in there?
Yeah. I mean, Trump is out there saying don't touch Social Security.
Trump is a moderate in the spirit of Mussolini. And I say that advisedly, not just as, a way of attacking him. There's a lot that has a popular appeal, sometimes suggests sincerity. I do think and he's moderate on foreign policy compared to Hillary Clinton. I thought his position, which was echoed by every single other person on that panel on the southern border and on immigration and the path to citizenship, was obscene. And the Republican Party last night categorically betrayed its historic position of being in favor of looser borders and immigration on the side of immigrants. I think they made a drastic error. This will stick. So I think they're great demagogues. I wouldn't call them moderate.
So the debate Bob was discussing that created what was about 12 hours of momentum for Marco Rubio before this Chris Christie news came out. And he got there in an interesting way, basically by throwing Donald Trump's shtick back at him. Even this morning on the stump, Marco Rubio was talking about what he saw Donald Trump doing during the breaks at the debate.
He called me Mr. Meltdown. Let me tell you something. Last night in the debate during one of the breaks, two of the breaks, he went backstage. He was having a meltdown. First, he had this little makeup thing applying, like, makeup around his mustache because he had one of those sweat mustaches. Then he asked for a full-length mirror. I don't know why because the podium goes up to here, but he wanted a full-length mirror. Maybe to make sure his pants weren't wet. I don't know.
So, Rich, if it turns out that the way to beat Trump is to act like him and throw his shtick right back at him and be vulgar like he is, where does that leave the Republicans as a party and where does it leave us as a country?
Well, it's not very edifying, obviously, but everyone has to play by Trump rules. He is the alpha male on the stage. He has won to the extent he has won these debates by interrupting and insulting everyone else and constantly establishing his dominance over him, over everyone else. So the only way really to fight back is to play the same game. And Marco Rubio did it very effectively last night. It was Donald Trump's worst moment in any debate, and he was mocked and made a figure of fun. And it created an opening for Rubio. Now we'll see whether it's closed by the Christie endorsement. If I could just go back, Josh, to the point you're making about moderates. This really is the revenge of the Northeastern moderates. And you see it underlined with the Christie endorsement. And if Trump wins the nomination, it will prove you can win the nomination as a Northeastern moderate so long as you say you're pro-life, so long as you're very tough on immigration, so long as you're kind of outrageous and you hate the media. And you actually look at his positions. I was just thinking about this the other day. It's going to be an advantage in a general election if he gets there that he's an unprincipled moderate. And you look at his positions. Building a border wall is popular with people. Opposing entitlement reforms is popular with people. Opposing interventionism abroad is popular with people. You actually look at this stuff. Mass deportation is not. I believe he'll find some way to wiggle out of it. But his five or six core things are fairly popular with the public.
Yeah, Juliet, it's funny because, I mean, one of the things Chris Christie said in endorsing Trump is that Bill and Hillary Clinton will immensely fear him. And if you look at the polls now, that seems wrong. Trump does worse in the horse race. But if you strip away all of the act and the bluster and just sort of plot Donald Trump's position on a grid on policy issues, he probably is closer to the median voter than any of the other candidates. Is that a reason to think that he actually will end up being a strong candidate?
Yes, I absolutely believe that any Democrat who can put Donald Trump in a nice little corner and say that's the stupid people, that's the racist people, that's the whatever people is missing what is going on, not just with the Republican Party, as Rich and some of his colleagues have written about, but I think what's going on in national politics. I don't like making the Sanders-Trump comparison, but it does appear that, you know, just depending on what happens, that Hillary Clinton will is more likely than not to get the nomination, meaning we, the Democrats, have headed off this kind of anti-establishment revolt to a certain extent. But the idea that Democrats or independents won't find Trump appealing, I think Democrats delude themselves. And there might be, you know, the Hispanic vote might be strong enough. The woman's vote might be strong enough. There might be enough identity politics that favor Hillary Clinton. But I'm looking at the same numbers you both, you know, all three of you do in terms of the exit polling. And there's something going on here that can't be put into a nice little corner of, well, he's just an anti-establishment Republican. Trump is something else. And that's, you know, it's what Chris Christie said today, which is, you know, he's breaking all the rules. I think those rules will impact the general against Hillary
as well.
By the
way, what's wrong with being anti-establishment? This country was founded on the idea that the establishment should be challenged, overthrown, when it was the establishment that came from England. The whole idea of our Constitution is there's supposed to be avenues for popular resentment to be suggested. And what Sanders and Trump, and actually now a large number of the candidates, seem to at least accept is that most Americans are deeply unhappy. Maybe that hasn't gotten through to the chatter class in Washington. But the fact is, you know, there's a reason not to go with the old. And I just think that to dismiss it, to this mood in the country, and I disagree with you. If Sanders doesn't get it, that doesn't mean all these younger people, particularly and more liberal people, are just going to fall in behind Hillary Clinton.
I think the opposite.
Well,
I actually think that I think for Democrats, so there's a question about being anti-establishment and being qualified to be president. I mean, maybe I'm, you know, too moderate, and I'm willing to admit that. But I do think that both Trump and Sanders, I'm not convinced that they hold the basic attributes of what I would feel comfortable with in terms of a president. That being said, I am with you on believing that the woman, the and others are not necessarily behind Hillary, and that Trump is going to make a run from them. I mean, a lot of the people where Trump is number one, Sanders is number two in terms of their voting behavior, and the same applies vice versa.
Let us know what you think about Donald Trump's new establishment support at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Gitmo and the iPhone. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times and MSNBC. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the KCRW podcast, Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Juliette Kayyem, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and author of the forthcoming book called Security Mom, is also with us. So President Obama is making his last-ditch attempt to close the prison in Guantanamo Bay, a goal he has had from day one of his presidency. So, Juliette, as I understand it, there are broadly three categories of prisoners at Gitmo. There are some who are either on trial or have been charged with an offense. There are some who have been cleared for release, but there's no country that's willing to take them, so we sort of can't send them anywhere. And then we have a number who are in neither position. They're not charged with anything, but they're too dangerous to be deemed suitable for release. Does the president have an adequate approach for dealing with all three of those groups?
Well, I think he does, with a big caveat, which is, you know, there is a statute out there that prohibits the movement of Guantanamo detainees to the United States for whatever purpose, whether it's to go through a criminal justice system, the military justice system, or to be detained until some further determination is made. I do not believe that this president will do an executive order to close Guantanamo Bay in sort of direct conflict of a congressional statute. I think that that is it's legally tenuous. And I think that it's he certainly knows that if the next president is Trump, it's going to be overturned in a minute. I think what the exercise Obama went through in the last week was still very important, because what people in government like me and others who have been in it understand is government doesn't move unless it's forced to move. We have heard stories about the recalcitrance of the Department of Defense and even beginning any process of determination of what to do with these detainees. And so what I think Obama did is something that should not be rejected or criticized simply because he may not be able to close Guantanamo in his term. And that is, he's gotten that number down pretty low. There are only about 90 detainees. I think, given the list that I've seen that's been publicly distributed, I think that number can probably get down to 40 or 50 detainees. That's not a great number. It is not a happy number. It's a horrible, horrible place. I wish we could close it. And all that stuff. We all know what it means. But I want to say, sort of kudos to the effort to get that number to something that seems slightly more manageable than the high of 1,000 or certainly the couple of hundreds that were on Guantanamo Bay right when President Obama took the oath of office. I will say also, it does say something that no new detainees were put on Guantanamo Bay over the course of this administration. So there are good news stories out of this, but I think ultimately, unless there is some secret deal with the Senate to get these detainees onto U.S. soil, which is essentially what you have to do, we're still going to be looking at a couple dozen on Guantanamo Bay at the end of the Obama administration. Sadly.
But isn't the fundamental problem at Guantanamo that we're holding people indefinitely without trial? I don't know how much it matters that they're in Cuba. I mean, if you somehow got Congress to let us bring these people back and hold them on a military base on the mainland, you'd still have this issue that we're holding people indefinitely.
I think that's I'm not defending that. I think separating Guantanamo as the place and Guantanamo as the process is really important. We haven't resolved the process issue, which is the detainee standards are not adequate for due process. We should have put these guys either through the criminal justice system or the traditional uniform code of military justice at the get-go. There's this third tribunal called the military tribunals, which haven't even started yet because everything is being litigated. These are the 9/11 masterminds, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So the whole thing is not adequate from the perspective of detention policy. But Guantanamo as a place, regardless if you've solved the process issue, also has to be closed. And I'd rather have this debate with Guantanamo closed than this debate with Guantanamo open.
Bob, what do you see as the resolution here? I mean, given that we have these people in custody, if the government's position is that they can't try these people for whatever reason, but they're too dangerous to release, what would you do with them? I mean, would you just release them into the United States?
Well, first of all, you can't accept this idea that you can't try them because they're too dangerous. We had the Nuremberg trials. We tried very dangerous people, and you either believe in the rule of law or not. And it was the 9/11 Commission that had a criticism of the government, even back then, the bipartisan commission that said they weren't allowed to talk to these key actors, one of whom is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, find out their story, find out what this is all about. This is part of the education of the public. That's why we believe in open trials. That's why we believe in information. But I also make another point. We have kept up this insane policy of a war stance, and we try to overthrow the government of Cuba, insane policy, because Cuba does not support human rights, and Cuba has imprisoned its people, et cetera, et cetera. And yet we through previous imperial adventure, seized a portion of Cuba, which is where Guantanamo is, and we turned it into the historic torture camp and imprisonment camp standing in the eyes of the world. Oh, this is what the United States means by freedom. And so the significance of it being a seized part of Cuba at a time, by the way, when we're developing normal relations with Cuba, thanks to the Pope's initiative, is an absurd image to be holding up for the world.
Rich, is the strategy at Guantanamo tenable indefinitely? I would note that both Marco Rubio and Donald Trump, despite being on opposite sides of this internal party debate, they're both saying we should be putting more people into Guantanamo Bay.
I don't take that too seriously. I don't think a Republican president is going to send anyone else there. But you get this irreducible problem that there are people you can't responsibly release, and you also can't try, so you have to hold them. And what difference does it make whether you're holding them in Gitmo or you're holding them in Fort Leavenworth? And the fact is, a lot of Democratic representatives oppose bringing them onto American soil. So there you are. You're stuck with Gitmo. And the fact is, a war is different than a cop walking the beat. And if you capture someone on the battlefield and then interrogate that person because you think he might be very dangerous and know things, dangerous things that are happening, and be able to provide helpful information, you immediately are working from a different model than the criminal justice system. Because in the criminal justice system, you capture such a person, you read him his Miranda rights, you give him a lawyer, and he has the right not to talk to you, and you can't imply any coercion whatsoever. And that is just not a very good model for the war on terror. And since the Obama administration doesn't want to really acknowledge that dilemma, it has solved it by just droning people, and instead of capturing anyone, just trying to kill everyone, which I'm not sure on human rights grounds whether that's a better policy than holding them. And Gitmo, you know, it's a symbol, especially during the Bush administration. We don't hear so much of it internationally since President Obama became president, but it is just a prison.
I want to turn very quickly to this story about the iPhone from the San Bernardino shooter, Syed Farouk. The way these phones work is if you try too many times to log in with the wrong password, they automatically wipe their own contents. So the FBI has this locked phone, doesn't know the password, wants to get in, and wants Apple to create a new version of their operating system that will basically allow the FBI to try unlimited password attempts. Apple says creating that technology, which doesn't already exist, would run the risk that it could get in the wrong hands and hackers would use it to undermine ordinary users' security. This is currently being fought in the courts between the government and Apple. Juliet, what's the right balance here? Should Apple be complying with this?
I think Apple has every right to litigate this until either a court or Congress steps in. So I'm not as concerned about, you know, Apple challenging this. What I sort of is annoying me about this case is there's sufficient evidence that Apple has helped the government in a lot of cases. And we have every reason to believe, especially since there was a terrorism incident in San Bernardino, that they didn't walk into those meetings saying, we're not going to help the FBI now. If there ever was a case, it's this case. But at some stage, me, you, and everyone listening to this show learned about this because of essentially FBI leaks. I am very content to have the FBI and Apple have worked this out in some way in which maybe the phone is handed over or something happens in which they figure out what is on that phone. I believe that both parties probably wanted that to be the result. I think the FBI wanted to litigate a big case in terms of encryption and backdoor technology, and this was the case they wanted to litigate it over because it was San Bernardino, and shame on the FBI, because in the end, all that matters to anyone is not the civil liberties or not the technology or not the privacy rights. It is that we get the best case and understand what happened in San Bernardino, and we could have done that without this pitchfork battle.
Bob, is it desirable for people to have unsearchable communications devices? It seems like it would be good if the FBI was able to get into Syed Farouk's phone like they would have been able to with lower tech devices in previous years.
Okay, look, the something that happened was Edward Snowden. And as long as the government was able to break into fiber optic cables and spy on everybody's phone and everything else in the world, Apple and Google and others did go along. Sometimes they pushed back a little bit. But once the world public became aware of it, it created a great problem for multinational companies that are involved in the information age. Because, you know, you're in other countries and you are competing. In the case of China, the two largest companies are Chinese companies that Apple is competing with. And you are saying, no, we're different. We are multinational corporations, whether we're Facebook or Instagram or Google, and we are loyal to our citizens, customers around the world, but they're citizens of different countries. And in fact, because we believe in freedom, we can protect their privacy. And so the real issue here is the FBI is saying we're special, this crisis is special. First of all, that's a lie. They have enormous amount of information that they manage to disregard. There is not one single example of a terrorist act, or whether it was Boston, whether it's Charlie Hebdo, anyone else, where you could say there's some information they could have gotten if they could have violated privacy more. No, on the contrary, they had so much information. They bought the 19th hijacker was somebody who was living at the home of an FBI informant. They didn't bother to make that connection. So there's not a lack of information here. What is involved is whether and it's a very important case, whether a multinational corporation can uphold standards that are worldwide standards. That you have a right to expect some privacy within your own phone. Chief Justice Roberts, who I notice is attacked by the entire Republican panel last night, I think is a great hero on civil liberties, and certainly in this respect, has very clearly stated modern technology does not trump the concerns of the founders that we have individual private space. So both on practical grounds, Apple's drive for encryption is admirable. It does not make the country less safe. On the contrary, a free people feeling their communications is protected are people who will challenge their own government and be vigilant in protecting freedom.
Just very quickly, there's no privacy concern here. The man who had the phone is dead. There's obviously probable cause to search his phone because he is a terrorist, and he didn't even own the phone himself. The phone belonged to his employer, and he signed an agreement saying the employer could search the phone at any time. So there's not
encryption,
any private.
But encryption.
I know,
is
Bob.
Privacy.
Let me finish my point. So it's important to make distinctions here. There's no privacy right when it comes to searching this particular phone, and that's what the FBI wants. It doesn't want the Apple to give a back door to all encryption in this particular case. It just wants the software to force the passcode, which even with that software would be a very technologically sophisticated operation where you have to hook up a robot to the phone and punch in millions of combinations to get through the passcode. And Apple could immediately destroy the software it creates to allow the FBI to get in this passcode. The larger encryption debate, maybe Apple's right, but that doesn't necessarily is not necessarily involved in this particular question.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Juliette Kayyem, what's on your mind?
Cheryl Teagues, a 1970s supermodel, came out of hiding to criticize the Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition, which showed some very healthy-looking models in bathing suits. And all I have to say to Cheryl Teagues is, we really didn't miss you.
Bob Scheer, it's your soapbox.
Yeah, and a particularly stupid moment of a stupid debate last night in the Republican. Both Rubio and Cruz talked about their fathers coming to this country fleeing Castro's communism. And no one had the presence of mind in the fact-checking or on the panel to say, wait a minute, you guys are lying. They didn't flee Castro. Castro was up in the mountains. It was Batista, and he was a puppet of the United States. This was a U.S. protectorate you were fleeing. And you were fleeing for the same reason people come here, to improve your economic situation. You were the undocumented immigrants, the illegal immigrants. Your fathers were, and they got into this country because a year later, Castro came to power and they could use the anti-communist card.
Rich Lowry, what's your rant?
Ben Shapiro, a conservative polemicist, spoke at California State University, Los Angeles, and literally a riot broke out. Protesters physically tried to block the entrances to his speech, and Shapiro had to be escorted by the police. Afterwards, there are brown shirts loose on the college campuses, and they are from the left.
So in one of the funnier moments of last night's debate, Donald Trump explained that he can't release his tax returns because he's being audited. Not only is he being audited this year, he seems to be audited basically every year. He said as many as 12 years, and he thinks it's very unfair that they keep auditing him. I think this has to be the first time that a candidate in a presidential debate has bragged about how much he gets audited and didn't seem to worry that that was going to make people wonder that maybe Donald Trump is doing sketchy things in his taxes. Now, that said, Donald Trump said, well, maybe it's because they know I'm such a strong Christian. Conservatives have become so enamored of these IRS conspiracy theories that maybe they will even believe that Donald Trump is a victim. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Juliette Kayem. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Hannah Taysen is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.